want to speak about something that's relevant to this week's Sedra and to Shavuos. I'll give you a little preparation for Shavuos. The Medrash says in Bamidbar Rabbah, Lama Bamidbar Sinai, why was the Torah given in a desert? Mikan Shonu Chachomim Begimul Dvorim Nitna Torah Be'esh Uvamayim Uvamidbar. The rabbis taught from here that the Torah was given in three venues. It was given in the Midbar. It was given through fire. God spoke from the fire on the top of Har Sinai. And it was given through water. Because when the Matan Torah took place, it was raining. It said that the heavens poured out their rain. So it was given through water also. The Lama Nitna Begimul Dvarim Halalu. Why was the Torah given through these three things? Helama Elu Chinam the Chol Boyolam Kach Divrei Torah Chinam Heim Shenemar Hoy Kol Tzom Elu Chulamayim. Just like these three things are free, so too Torah is free to everyone. As it says, anybody who's thirsty, go get the water of Torah. Now, in the past, I understood this medrash to mean that the Torah itself is compared to these three things. And we do find that. Torah is compared to fire, Torah is called water, and the Torah is compared to a desert. But now, looking at the medrash again this year, I understand it completely differently. It's not that the Torah itself is compared to these three things. That may be true, and it may be a different idea. But here the Medrash is trying to bring out the following. In order to be able to accept the Torah, and to observe the Torah, and to learn the Torah, you need a certain environment. You need certain conditions. You need a certain medium from which the Torah can be received and observed properly. And the Torah, therefore, was given through these three mediums. They were the environment, the water, the fire, and the desert, which enable one, they're the kalim, the machshirim, they're the machshir. They are the things that enable a person to be able to really learn and observe the Torah, and receive the Torah. So, you have to understand what they are. Right? What are the conditions, the enabling factors, the mediums through which one can get the Torah? Because the Torah is free. But if you can't get it, if it's inaccessible, then it's not free. So in order to make the Torah really free to everybody, you have to get it through things that they themselves are free. These mediums are free. So they don't inhibit the getting of the Torah, which is free. In fact, they enhance it. So how does that work? The first one is Midbar, desert. That in order to be able to receive the Torah, you have to go into a virtual desert. That's the first medium for Kabbalah Satorah. What does that mean? That means that you have to cut yourself off from physical material things. That doesn't mean that you have to cut yourself off completely. That means that you have to cut yourself off from dependency on them. When you go in a desert, you can't depend on the physical material world. You're cut off from it. And that's what it says in the Mishnah, in Pirkei Avos. Kachi darka shel Torah. You want to know if you're on the path of Torah? Then this is it. Pas v'melech tochal, eat bread and salt, drink water, sleep on the floor, live a life of privation. And if you do that, and you're still, oh, sikba Torah, the Torah to amel, ashrecha, the tovlach, it's good for you, and you're fortunate, you're good for you in this, it's good, you're fortunate in this world, it's good for you in the next world. Now that can't be taken literally, that the only people who are bederech haTorah, people don't eat more than bread and salt and drink water, and sleep on the floor. Because it's not true. Right? There are plenty of gedolei Yisrael who eat more than bread and salt. And there's no gadol that I know of, that I ever met, that slept on the floor. They all slept in beds. So the only person I knew that slept on the floor was an old aunt I had with back trouble. So she slept on the floor. So she must have been the only person I ever knew who was bederech haTorah. So what does it mean? basically, it means the following. That, how would you feel if you didn't have all these pleasures, all these comforts, but you still were able to learn Torah and observe the Torah? If the ikkar in your life, what you consider your life, is learning and observing the Torah, so you can get olam haba, that's what this world is all about, then you still feel fortunate and good. But if the main thing of your life that you depend on for life, which makes you have a life, is all the physical material pleasures, then, and you're dependent on them, and if you don't have them, you're miserable, even though you have Torah, then obviously the Torah is not the ikkar. Then you're not bederech haTorah. So you can eat steaks and sleep on a Sealy mattress, but you can't be dependent on that. That's your life. That can enhance your life. But your life has to be Torah, and those things enhancements. But if those things become, you become dependent on them for having a life, then you're not bederech haTorah. So that's the first thing. You have to go through a virtual desert where you become independent, not dependent on the material, physical things of the world. Second thing is that you, in a desert, have to trust God. There's nothing else there to trust. There's nothing there that you can fall, that you can depend on to survive and to give you life. If the Rabban Shalom is not going to make you survive, you're not going to survive in the desert. So you have to have that implicit trust and faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and not faith and trust in other things in the world. That's another necessity, precondition, an enabling factor for Kabbalah Satorah. And that's a desert, you know, you can't fool yourself. That's why the Rabban Shalom put us in the desert for 40 years. That we should understand that we have to trust him. That you can't trust and depend on other things. And lastly, the desert represents a place that's hefker. Meaning you have to go to Torah desolate. Not with your own preconceived notions. You can't have your own values and standards and then try to learn Torah and fit it into your value system. You have to let the Torah create your value system for you. You have to go in clear, and the Torah provides you with your values and your standards, not the other way around, where you go in already populated with ideas and then see if you can make the Torah fit your ideas. In fact, somebody who has their own values and their own standards that are different than Torah values and standards, and they want to be frum, they want to keep mitzvahs. So I saw Rabbi Hollander from America says that it's not, that person does not have 613 mitzvahs. He has 613 problems. Because every mitzvah is a conflict with his values, standards, lifestyle, or whatever. So you have to let the Torah mold your lifestyle and values and standards, and not that first you have them and then, so you go into an unpopulated area, right, totally desolate, before you can let the Torah populate your ideas. And with that, I once wanted to explain Machlokas between the Dubna Magen and the Vilna Gaon, which on the surface seems to be mamish, one holds the opposite of the other, and that's very difficult because the Vilna Gaon and the Dubna Magen were, the Dubna Magen was a Talmud Chaver of the Vilna Gaon. He was a student, but the Vilna Gaon used to call him to what's it called, to give him Musa. So it couldn't be that their hashkafas are so different. Where do they argue? The Dubna Magid says on the Pasuk, Lo osi korosa Yaakov, ki yogata bi Yisrael. You didn't call on me, Yaakov, because you toiled too much, Yisrael. So he gives a marshal, as he usually does. He says somebody came to a train station and was unable to take his bag home with him. So when he got home, he told his son to go back and pick up his bag. So he hears the son from behind a closed door, trudging up the stairs, huffing and puffing with his bag. So he yells out from behind the door, go back and get my bag. He said, I brought your bag. He said, no, you didn't. He said, how do you know? You didn't even look. He said, because my bag was only a small attaché case. And if you're huffing and puffing up the stairs, you obviously took somebody else's baggage. So too, God says to us, you must not be doing my mitzvahs because you're working too hard. Mitzvahs are easy. Mitzvahs are not difficult. If you're having a hard time, you must not be doing them right. Yet the Vilna Gaon says just the opposite. The Vilna Gaon explains the pasuk in Rus. When the army saw that Rus was making such an effort to keep up with her, it was an effort for her to keep up the pace, she stopped trying to discourage her from becoming a convert. You're supposed to discourage a convert to make sure that they're really doing it l'shem shamayim. When did she know that Rus really meant it l'shem shamayim? There's no purpose to discourage her anymore. When she saw how much effort she's putting in, says the Vilna Gaon, when a mitzvah is too easy, it means that it's really not a quality mitzvah, because the sultan couldn't care less if you do it or not. She doesn't put up a fight. But when a mitzvah is a quality mitzvah, the sultan puts up a fight, and it becomes very difficult to do. So when Naomi saw how difficult it was for Ruth to keep up, and she's a young woman, and she was an old woman, must be that the sultan's giving her a lot of problems. That means that the mitzvah must be a quality mitzvah. She must be really doing this l'shem shamayim. So here the Vilna Gaon says just the opposite. That the harder the mitzvah is to do, the more of a indication is that it's a good thing. And if it's too easy, it's obviously not a quality mitzvah. And the Dubna Magid says just the opposite. If it's too hard, it's obviously not being done the right way. So I want to say one answer could be that they were talking about two different things. Rus wasn't involved in doing any specific mitzvah. She was a goy at the time. She was accepting the value system of Judaism, the whole framework. That's difficult. It's very difficult to create the right hashkafas, the right values and standards and outlooks of Yiddishkeit. And if that comes too easy, something's wrong. But once you have that, the mitzvahs are a cinch. Well, there may be outside reasons why they're difficult for you specifically, but not because of the mitzvah itself. If the mitzvah is done within the context, within the framework of the right outlooks and values and standards, then it's made to fit. So it's got to be easy. It's not a problem anymore. And so that is the idea of a desert. In order to receive the Torah properly, you have to first go through a desert. One, not be dependent on physical material things. Learn dependency on God. And not have preconceived notions. Go through that desolate area where you populate it with God's ideas and not that it's already populated with your ideas. Next, fire. What's the medium of fire? So fire, when you get close to it, you go through the fire, right? Close by, you get warmed up. In order to makabel the Torah, you can't be a cold fish. You have to have emotions. You have to be warmed up and inspired. You have to have the right emotions that the Torah should make an impression on you. Right? You have to have an excitement, a motivation for Torah. So you need that, what's it called? That zrizus, which comes from like fire. Fire as warms a person emotionally and mezaris him. Another thing, fire illuminates. It makes the darkness light. You have to open your eyes and observe and be aware and sensitive, right, to the Torah and all the limudim of the Torah. Because if you're not sensitive, you'll never accept the Torah. You'll never be able to learn it properly. So you need to be enlightened. You need to have your eyes open and it not be dark. Rabbi Akiva, how did he become Rabbi Akiva from being an ignoramus? Because he saw erosion. He saw drops of water eat away at a stone over time. And he said, if stone is so hard and water is so soft, yet the water, if it's consistent and persistent, can eat away the stone, then Torah, which is so hard, can surely eat away at my heart and penetrate it. And he became Rabbi Akiva. But if he wouldn't have been observant, he wouldn't have been sensitive to what he saw, he never would have become Rabbi Akiva. So in order to really accept the Torah properly, you have to have that sensitivity and that zrizus, that interest, and you also have to have what's it called, the emotional sensitivity, emotional and intellectual sensitivity. Another thing that fire is a means of doing work and producing industrial results. all of industry depends on fire. So if you have the medium of fire, you're going to be able to learn Torah and observe Torah in a positive and effective way. You're going to do it as a malacha. You're going to make it into something that is constructive. Right? You're going to be able to machadish Torah. You're going to be able to apply Torah. So you need that fire to make the Torah, what's the word I'm looking for? Effective and practical and not just theoretical. Another aspect is that you have to be willing to go through fire to get to Torah, meaning you have to get burned. You have to be willing to sacrifice, and even sometimes to sacrifice your life for the sake of the Torah. And that is a lesson that we learn by Har Sinai. It says that when the Torah was given, it was so overwhelming that they died. From the great fire where the Torah was given from, they died because their souls just fled them towards that fire. So God resurrected them. They died and he made them come back to life. So he's bothered me. Why did God let them die and then resurrect them? Wouldn't it have been easier just to make them have the power not to die? Stop them from dying. Why let them die and then have to resurrect them? Do a smaller miracle. But I think that God wanted to teach us a lesson. That sometimes you have to give up your life for Torah. But that same Torah, what brought them alive? The it says that God brought the dew of Tchias HaMeisim. Tau shel Tchias HaMeisim. What is the Tau of Tchias HaMeisim? That's the Torah itself. Torah Sashem Tamima Meshivas Nafesh. Torah itself restores your soul. So what do we learn from there? That you may sometimes have to sacrifice your life for Torah and die for Torah. But the Torah itself gives you back eternal life. So what you got back so overshadows what you lost that it's batlam avutl. So you never really have to sacrifice the Torah, because the greatest sacrifice you can make, you get in return something that is millions of times greater. You gave up physical life in this world and you got eternal life. So nothing, anything less than that, for sure, you're going to get in return much more than you gave up. So you have to be willing to, what's it called, to give up and sacrifice for Torah. And this concept is a very important one. Rav Moshe Feinstein, and it's important that you understand it properly also, because some people distort it also. There's two extremes over here, and both are not right. Rav Moshe Feinstein said the following. There was a whole generation in America in the beginning of the 1900s, the early 1910, 1920, when Jews came over from Europe, and many of them were Shomer Shabbos, but they gave up Shabbos because you couldn't get a job unless you worked on Shabbos in the sweatshops. If you didn't work on Shabbos, they fired you. You had to go look for another job. And then on Friday, you lost that job. And there weren't that many jobs available. So many people gave up Shabbos, but there were people who really were Moser Nefesh. And they went from job to job and sometimes didn't have what to eat. But their children gave up Shabbos. Here were people Moser Nefesh for Shabbos. And the children weren't Shomer Shabbos. Why? He said, because when they came home Friday night after losing their job for the 10th time and having to look for another job on Monday, they used to complain and krechts and sigh, oh, it's so hard to be a Jew and Shabbos is so difficult. So what did the kids hear? Oh, God, the Shabbos is a burden. So they said, when we get old enough, we're surely going to give up the Shabbos. Our parents are crazy. Why would they do these crazy things? But had they come home and said, Shabbos is beautiful and it's so sweet, and then the children would have, what's it called, would have kept Shabbos too. Now, and he says, that's what we say in Shemona Esrei, V'lo nevosh ki li'olam v'tochnu. Let's not be insulted, embarrassed that we serve you. It shouldn't be a source of embarrassment to us and a difficulty. We should be proud of it and we should be happy with it. But some people distort that to the other extreme. And they say, well, Torah has to be fun. And that's how they educate their children. Torah is always fun. So they have Torah games and learning, right? The computer games about the Gemara, right? So it's all fun. Fun and games. And Shabbos is such a fun day and we play games and who knows what else. It's really a fun day. If you educate your children like that, when they get a little bit older, not too much older, they're going to discover that not every key in the Torah is fun. I'm sure you've discovered that already, right? It's not all fun and games. There are very difficult things in the Torah that are definitely not fun for anybody. So what does it mean? On the one hand, you don't want to make it a burden. On the other hand, it's not fun. So what is it? It's worth it. Sometimes you have to do things that are difficult, involve effort, and even sacrifice. But if you know that it's worth it, then that in itself makes it fulfilling and makes it satisfying. It may not be fun, it may be hard work, but it's worth it. If you know you're digging for a treasure, you know for sure that 30 feet under the ground, under solid rock, is $10 million in treasure. But you have to go at it with pickaxes every day and make a few inches progress, and it's backbreaking, and you have to sit under the elements or on top of some mountain in the Andes digging for this treasure. You have to put a lot of money into it, investment. But in the end, when you get the treasure, you realize that all of that was worth it. And if you think, and you know for sure you're going to get the treasure, all of the work and the privation and the expense is worth it. That's how Torah has to be. It's not a burden. It's an opportunity. It may mean sacrifice, investment, difficulty, but it's all worth it. That's what you have to teach your children. It's not fun and games, but it's definitely kedai. It's definitely worth it. So that is the fire. How about the water? Water is a medium for cleanliness. You wash off dirt with water. It's a medium for spiritual purity. You go into the mikveh and you become spiritually pure on the inside. And water is also something that wakes you up. If you're tired, it revives you. Wash your face, right? Put cold water on your face and it wakes you up. Or get a nice drink of water, right? Wakes you up. So Torah has to have that medium also before it. You have to be clean and pure before you can really accept and observe the Torah. So you have to clean off your midos, the external things. That's like washing. And then you have to, what's it called, purify your inside, right? Also, that you have pure thoughts and pure actions or whatever. And for that, you have to immerse yourself totally in the Torah in order to get that purity. And also, the Torah has to always be new to you and something that you always adapt to new situations, just like the water makes something exciting and new and refreshing. Torah can't be an old, hackneyed thing. You have to constantly look at it as something new and be able to adapt it to all new kinds of situations. So that's the water. So those are the three mediums that if you don't have these makshirim, if you don't have these enabling factors, which are free, then you won't be able to get the Torah. The Torah is also free. But if you would have to pay to enable it, then the Torah would, for all practical purposes, wouldn't be free. So the enabling things have to be free because the Torah itself is free. And these enabling things are the desert, which we explained, the fire, and the water. Now, I think with this we can explain something else from the Sedra. The Sedra starts with events that happened in the beginning of the second month of the second year that they left Mitzrayim, Rosh Chodesh Iyar. Yet in next week's Sedra, in Naso, right, it discusses what happened when the Mishkan was dedicated. When the Shechina came down, right, on the eighth day of the Miluim. The Miluim started on the 23rd of Adar, and they culminated on the first day of Nisan. And that's when God's presence came down into the Mishkan, and that's when the Mizbeach started to be dedicated by the 12 sacrifices of the Nisim for the next 12 days. So that discusses things that happened a month earlier. Why did the Torah tell us what happened a month later before the things that happened a month earlier? Why in next week's Sedra is there the events of the first day of Nisan the second year, and in this week's Sedra, the events of the first day of the year of the second year? Just thinking, the Torah wanted to teach us the following. The whole purpose of the Shechina, devolving in the Mishkan, the whole purpose of the Mishkan, really, its main purpose, was to be a place where the giving of the Torah on Har Sinai could continue on an ongoing basis. First in the Midbar and the Mishkan, and then the Beis HaMikdash, and the second Beis HaMikdash, and eventually the third Beis HaMikdash. That is the continuation of Maimed Har Sinai. Now, the truth is, it didn't have to have that function until they left Har Sinai. As long as they were Har Sinai, it was basically the same thing. But when did it become the continuation? When they left Har Sinai. When did they leave Har Sinai? On the 20th day of the year. Okay? So, we have the following sequence. You have the first day of the year, then the first day of Nisan, then the 20th day of the year. That's a sequence of events. Meaning the following. The Torah wanted you to know that before the purpose of the Shechinah coming into the Mishkan was fulfilled on the 20th day of the year, you needed on the first day of the year to have the events that happened in this week's Seder. That was, they were in the desert, and they were what's it called, counted, and they set up their living around the Mishkan. They created the machanos, the camps. The camp of Israel, the camp of the Levim, the camp of the Shechinah. And everything circled around the Mishkan. You had to have that first. And only after that could come the continuation of the giving of the Torah that was in the Mishkan. So therefore the Torah put this before the actual Shechinah coming, right? Even though it happened afterwards. But even though it happened afterwards, it happened before the Shechinah and the Mishkan became really operable as a continuation of Har Sinai, because they still were in Har Sinai at that point. But the Torah wanted us to know that this is a prerequisite. And how does that fit the three things we said? First of all, they were in the desert. But Midbar Sinai. So they were in the desert, they were in that medium. All the things that the desert represents. And then, in the place of fire, they were counted. How does counting relate to fire? We said fire arouses a person, enlightens him, warms him up, and that you have to be able to sacrifice. What happened? They were counted. How were they counted? They gave a half a shekel. Now the half a shekel, the Gemara says, corresponded to a half a shekel of fire in the heavens. It represented sacrifice. You had to give, you had to invest, you had to give a half a shekel away. And it was like fire. And being counted inspired you. It said, you're important. It made you open your eyes and get a good feeling about yourself. At the same time, it made you responsible. That you have responsibility because God expects picking up your head. So pick up your head and look around, see how important you are, see what potential you have, right? That's the fire. Be ready to invest and sacrifice that money that you have to give to be counted. And therefore, it had the whole gamut of what fire represents, including the fact that the half a shekel is represented by a half a shekel of fire. And lastly, the fact that they made the machaneh, the camp of Israel and the camp of the Levim and the camp of the Mishkan, and they all centered around the Mishkan, was a symbol of purity, of water. How so? First of all, every camp had to be pure. The camps had to be pure. And if you had to go and take care of your bodily functions, you went out of the camp. So physical cleanliness was represented by that. And if you were Tameh, you couldn't be in the camp either. Certain kinds of Tumah for different camps. So you had to go out of the camp for Tumah too. So the camp represented purity. It also represented purity of genealogy. The families were pure. And that's how they were counted. That's how they knew how to dwell, where to be. Each one according to his family lineage. And in addition, everything centered around the Mishkan. It was like a big mikvah. You're immersed. Instead of the Mishkan immersing you, you immersed yourself around the Mishkan. So it was like putting yourself in a mikvah by focusing totally everybody on that one thing. And when the Jewish people are united, also it's a symbol of purity. Because all Jews together are considered tzaddikim. Each individual has his problems. But when we put us all together, everybody makes up for everybody else's problems, and we end up okay. We end up at Tzadik HaTomer Yifrach. Klal Yisrael, compared to a palm tree, a date palm, is called a tzadik. Because the date palm even has thorns. But the thorns, as long as they're part of the tree, and you're looking at the tree in general, the thorns are also important. If you cut the thorns off, they're thorns. They're negative. But if they're part of the tree, they're okay also. So even Poshe Yisrael, as long as they haven't separated themselves totally from the Jewish people, right, even if they're not perfect, but they're still part of the Jewish people, they haven't cut themselves off, then they're also considered tzaddikim. So therefore, the that which happened in this week's Sedra is the same thing that corresponds to the mediums, to the enabling factors that go into receiving and accepting the Torah. And since the God's presence in the Mishkan was a continuation of what happened to Har Sinai, the continuation of the giving of the Torah and the receiving of the Torah, so therefore the Torah said before you can have that, you have to have this. And even though chronologically it happened later, that's because for all practical purposes, these things weren't needed till the Mishkan left Har Sinai. So they didn't happen before they left Har Sinai. But first we had the Shechinah there to give us a little help in having these enabling things so that when the Mishkan will leave Har Sinai, we'll be able to be ready to re-accept the Torah, can accept it and on an ongoing basis.